Welcome back to Chad and Steve Have a Podcast. I'm really excited to be joined today by Christopher Bill, a composer, arranger, music director, video maker, and YouTuber. Oh, and I forgot to mention the most important thing. He's a trombonist. This is what people mean when they say you need to niche down on YouTube. Christopher started posting videos on his channel Classical Trombone back in 2011. That's 12 years ago for those of us who can't thoroughly comprehend the insane speed at which time passes. His work is just so cool, not just because he's an amazing trombone player, but how he's managed to transform it into a really versatile instrument by interpreting popular songs in a completely new light. Not to mention the quality of his production, the video editing, his mixing. The videos are just so much fun to watch. Christopher, it's good to see you again. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So you're still traveling around the country. You're a nomad, aren't you?
I am, as of about a year ago today.
Wow. Would you just stay in Airbnbs or just live in your car?
I've converted the Tesla Model Y into a fully functioning camper, and as you can see today, recording studio. So, yeah.
That's incredible.
Cars make the best recording studios, though. The sound quality is so good in them.
Yeah, I mean, I've got some acoustic paneling I put up around, but
wow,
it's a little boomy sometimes with brass instruments, I will say.
It's a blast.
Yeah, exactly.
You might say.
That's a whole word salad. So how do you introduce yourself when people are like, hey, what do you do for a living?
So I guess it depends who I'm talking to, because for a long time I was not really taken seriously in the music world because I was just like the kid making YouTube videos. And then In the YouTube world, you know, I didn't have enough followers to be considered a YouTuber. So it kind of depended who I was talking to. But eventually it became clear I needed to include both to be anything, because as a trombonist, there's plenty of people who are more accomplished. And as a YouTuber, there are plenty of people who are more accomplished. So you really need to combine those things until you're the only one left, I think.
There's not a lot of trombonists doing what you do on YouTube, I would like to think.
No. And the ones that are now were clearly like following in my footsteps, which feels cool.
They're just copying you.
But like they're doing it in creative new ways, which is always fun. But yeah, like clearly they saw my videos and they're like, oh, that's a possibility. And when I started, there was nobody. So it's different. But I mean, what they do is crazier than anything I could ever think of, especially with short form and stuff. Like they're thinking of it in a completely different landscape than I am.
What were you thinking about when you were uploading? You've been uploading videos for, when did you start your channel?
12 years.
Oh my goodness.
12 years.
So, and some of your oldest videos are there, and they seemed like focused videos.
They're fine. the original ones, I do keep them all up. But yeah, I mean, I was really just like an arranger, writing music for different groups and then recording all the parts myself as kind of a, like, hey, you could buy this arrangement. It was less about me and more about the actual writing. And then a couple of those blew up and I started writing for myself and for the channel. But I mean, I had a YouTube channel before that I thought was going to make me famous, doing like song skits, musical comedy, and that didn't work. So I was always kind of testing different things out. But this YouTube channel, the one that actually did work, was not meant to, it was just for me to like put my work up. It wasn't even to show people, really.
Hmm. So you had a channel before this one. When did you start on YouTube?
That would have been 2009 or 10. Yeah.
Wow.
I know. What about you guys? When did you guys start?
I was 2008, so I've been around.
Okay. You know.
I realized that if that is your first video, which was 2011, and you set up your account like 2009, we were 2008, and our first video was 2010. So in and around the exact same time, I realized.
Yeah. So, I mean, you guys maybe even know that, like, when I started, I couldn't make money on YouTube if I had anything that wasn't completely my own, like, copyright.
Oh,
so any
right,
of my covers, right. None of that. I could. So my channel was completely demonetized for the first, I don't know, 3-4 years. until they started opening it up to, oh, you can actually split revenue for covers and things. So it was, it really was a hobby.
What were you doing to earn a living at that time?
I was in school. So I had the luxury of being able to do this as a hobby on the side for fun. And it really, that's all it was. And then overnight one day they signed a deal with all the major record labels and I was making like decent money literally overnight one day, because I had already had, I don't know, 70 videos of this stuff up, something like that. And then overnight all of them made money.
Instant monetization, damn.
Yeah, it was really strange, to be honest.
What was the first video to blow up?
So the first one, there was one that was, it's funny because I had one that, that really blew up, like made it to the front page of Reddit, but that's not the one for me that feels like it, because the first one to blow up for me was the one that got like 1,000 views, right? And so that was Fireflies by Owl City. I did like a cover of that. And that was really the first one that I made for me. The rest of them I was writing for other people. And that was the first one that people in my life were like, hey, I saw that video. It was pretty cool.
You must have struck right when the when it was really hot, Firefly.
Yes, huge. That was like, it must have been 2010 or 11, yeah, something. Yeah. And then, yeah, Happy by Pharrell Williams was the one that actually like proper went viral, where non-trombonists were watching it. And that's a whole different weird thing when people out of your niche are seeing it and commenting and providing their feedback, when you're like, this wasn't for you, but it's cool that you're seeing it, but okay.
What do you think is the appeal to non-trombonists? Just the fact that it's a trombone.
So that one I was doing with a guitar looping pedal. And so that was the kind of more broad, like you're watching it be composed in real time, basically. And at the beginning, just watching a trombone playing one note at a time, it's very strange. Like, why am I watching this? And you see like, oh, it has millions of views. So clearly people are watching this, but why? And then you see like it unfold in it. I think it's cool. That has been completely overplayed on the short form stuff now. But at the time, nobody was doing it with, especially instrumental music. So it was kind of fun.
So like another Reddit success story, which was actually also the case for us, our first video kind of came indirectly from a Reddit pop. How did that change then how you kind of approached your content, and did you start looking at it like, oh, if I lean into this, I got to do it this way?
Yeah, it's so interesting you bring this up, because I just went out to the Patreon Creator Fest a couple of weeks ago, and you know they're focusing on this question of, are you making stuff for the audience? Are you making stuff for the algorithm? Are you making stuff for you? And at the time, I was definitely like, still just making stuff for me, basically. And also like looking at the charts, at the top 10 hits, you know, it's a little bit easier to think about this question when you're thinking about it's all music. So I'm not saying like, oh, should I do reaction videos? Should I do this? Should I do that? I'm just saying, what music should I play? And so still there's this idea of, well, what are people looking for? What are people listening to? And so I look at the top 10, and for a while, you know, I've been here for a while, so maybe 4 or 5 years in that, I always wanted to have 8 of the top 10 on YouTube, eight of the top 10, like Hot 100 covers on YouTube at any given moment. And that's kind of what brought this audience in, but it was still like brass players, instrumental musicians and stuff. So it was a little push and pull. I tried to make sure I was loving what I was doing no matter what. If it was a song that was really boring and repetitive, I tried to make it fun for me at least. So I was never just doing something that like, well, somebody's going to like this, but it's not me. I tried never to do that. And I don't think I have.
Do you have any kind of like there's that whole 80-20 split, you know, you can do 80% for your audience, what they want, and 20% for you. What would be your 20%, or do you just consider this basically your 20% because it's all kind of for you?
No, I mean, the stuff I definitely have done, like the ones that are just for me. There was one called Space Race by Billy Preston, and it was like, nobody was asking for that. It was this B-side like funk tune that's completely instrumental from like the 70s. This is not something people are searching for, but it's really fun. I was listening to it a ton, and I was getting burnt out from doing the like Ariana Grande every single week, and I was like, I just need to do one. I need to do one for me. And I would also do like a pretty big ambitious thing every like December So like my album I did, or I would do these like 25 days of Christmas where I'd do a new video every day, a new song literally every day.
That's amazing.
Leading up to Christmas. I did that for 4 years, and these big ambitious projects kind of pulled me out of that, like the grind, even though that's more grindy. It was like, at least it's,
it is.
The deadlines are happening faster, and so I can't get so bogged down. So I would always like kind of get burnt out. I did a giant like 9-city tour 1 year and did a concert. So every year I would kind of get to that point where like, I'm just making a video every week. Like, how monotonous is this? And then I'd have to like pull myself out and do something big and crazy.
Are you the kind of person who functions well under that self-imposed pressure? Like one video a day for a month?
I mean, yeah, I've been doing, After I got on the road, it's the first time I haven't done a video every week in 10 years. So yeah, I definitely thrive under that. And it's actually weird not having that for a bit. And I'm like kind of having to impose that again because it's aimless otherwise.
You're such a slacker now, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I went and visited your Spotify account, and it looks like 2014 and 2017 you released albums. Is that correct, or is that just the stuff that's on Spotify?
There's singles out, but those are the albums. There was like a instrumental album, there's a Christmas album, and then like the big pop one was, yeah, I guess 17, 18, somewhere around there.
Which had some really beautiful songs on there.
Thank you.
I'm wondering what's the process like for going through and like writing an album?
Yeah, that one was really strange. So I had my writing partner, Will Prinzi, he's out in California, but he's kind of bopped around as well. And he was in New York in a band that was going on Warped Tour and like having some pretty good success. And then the band broke up. And so he was living with, it was basically two of my college roommates. And they had the rest of the lease that they were just there. And then their girlfriends were basically taking over. They were like, we were moving to New York so you could do this band thing. The band broke up. It's our turn. And so they went, and you know, that's actually why I'm here in Asheville, North Carolina. So visiting one of them, like they basically got jobs. And so like, you're coming with us now. So for the meantime, they were there, they had no work. And I hired him to basically produce this album with me. And so the process was very, very collaborative, where we were both bringing songs to each other. We were working every single day, tried to get it done in 2 weeks, took 2 months. And going into like the YouTube space in New York to record. So doing it very like, we had one day in the recording studio, we brought all our gear, loaded in, and of course I'm singing on everything. And so I'm like, my voice can only last so long, so we shouldn't do too many takes of everything. But it was, yeah, I mean, it was just the two of us. We recorded everything on that album. I had a friend who happened to be in town that day in the city, and we said, come on over, and she sang on one of the tracks. And like that, it was very much like, let's just get it done. And, basically we'd have this thing where like, if he was happy and I was happy, we'd move on. There's no more like, oh, well, let's get one in the can just in case. There was no more just in case. It was, do we both like it? Great. Then we're moving on.
And that's cool. You can both be on the same page that way, because sometimes there's somebody with a perfectionist tendency that kind of prevents that.
And he definitely had that. And so if he wasn't happy with it, we'd do it again. But we just get very much bogged down in this, in the recording studio, like, oh, let's just get one just in case. And then the one just in case isn't as good. And so you keep trying to get back to that thing that you did before, which is fine. And then everybody's tired and you don't have enough time. So we just try it, and it was great. I mean, having those similar restrictions for time and deadlines. I mean, I'm very happy with how it turned out, but he did all the strings, he did all the percussion and stuff. And I did obviously all the brass, and we wrote probably half and half. I brought songs in that I had written years before, and we kind of reworked them and stuff that I did for YouTube videos and stuff, and just kind of brought this whole thing together. It's really weird and like eclectic, but I'm really happy with it. Yeah.
Is there a reason why you haven't written an album since?
So we went to the studio, who's living in Phoenix, and we wrote and recorded all the demos. And that was March of 2020. which you may
for that month
think something happened to
the
that
whole year.
So we were literally in the studio. He was working at a studio in Phoenix, and he said they literally let me have the studio for free. I just like don't get paid that those days, but we can book it out and use it for free. And so I brought a third writing partner in. We flew out to Phoenix and we're in the studio every single day, you know, 18 hours, not looking at the news, not looking at our phones. And then like by the end of the week, my writing partner from New York was like, I think I got to go home because I don't know that I'm going to be able to get home if I wait another day.
Right.
And we're like going out to restaurants and the restaurants are closed. And we're like, what's going on? So the songs are kind of written. And then, yeah, I mean, it just, we literally haven't picked up since he moved. And like, yeah, I'm in my car now. So we do have an album. It's basically written and the demos are recorded, and it's just, I'm almost at the point where I'm like, I kind of have to shelve that and just start a new one, because that's such a thing that I feel like we all need to get back together and find those paths again. But we're right. kind of dealing with scheduling and everything. I don't want to like take those songs that we all wrote together and run with them. I want the three of us to do it. So yeah, I think I might actually end up doing this year a completely different album, even though that one's basically written.
What does a Christopher Bill live show look like? Do you gather up the same group of people that you collaborate with on these albums and just like, hey, let's put on a show kind of a thing? And how do you get gigs in this way? Not having, I assume you don't have like a set band.
Right. No. Most of what I do is a little bit more in the educational world for like universities and stuff. And for instrumental conservatory students, something like that. And so they'll have people that I can actually pull from to perform with. And so it's usually a different group of people everywhere I go. For example, my live show I did years ago, I was actually hiring three other trombone players everywhere I went. It's from the local symphony or whatever it was, basically hiring my heroes. Like when I went to LA, I hired all of my favorite recording artists, like trombonists who played on like Star Wars and everything. So super fun.
Oh, but that was exciting.
Do that. Oh, it was awesome.
People.
And they loved it because they're like, oh, you come to my town and offer me work playing like super fun music with basically no rehearsal. And I get paid.
Right.
And there's a big audience, which trombone players are not used to. So yeah, it was super fun. So that was like definitely a quartet, like acoustic vibe. I rented out big churches and stuff, which like these brass sounds so good in. But for the like more electronic stuff, I'm bringing a looper and I'm basically recording or I'm doing the performances alone. And post pandemic, I am doing basically all improvised shows, which is super fun and interesting. So I basically get like feedback from the audience in different ways depending on how many people are there, and yeah, make up the entire thing based on like this kind of given push and pull with the audience of what they want, what I'm doing. And yeah, it's basically a trombone, piano, and a bunch of like looping pedals and effects pedals.
That's such a non-traditional way for a trombone player to make a living, I'm sure. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that's got to be
that's
different
fair.
Than most trombonists.
Yeah, most trombonists go to school.
They play in an orchestra or something,
they
right?
They play in an orchestra. Trombone's great because it's in like jazz, it's in classical music, pop music. Like you can do a lot with it, but I'm not doing any of that. So yeah, it's I like to say I'm the most successful trombonist or most successful musician who's never won a gig. So it's not for lack of trying. Like I've definitely auditioned for different things. I've gotten to the end round of many different auditions. People have actually asked me to audition many times and I'm like, oh, this could be it. But I know in the end, like focusing all of that time and energy on my own stuff is going to have more longevity. It's going to be better for me. I'm going to feel more fulfilled. It's just more work. So I definitely hear them out and I'm like, okay, like I'll try my best and it would be awesome to have a paycheck and not have to worry about any of this other stuff. But yeah, at the end of the day, I'm like, well, I didn't get the gig, but like I now have all this time to focus on my own stuff, which is always better.
Does performing in like a symphony orchestra hold a certain appeal to you? And I mean, is this why the name of your channel is Classical Trombone?
That's a great question. It's I got it in high school. I literally like got the username in high school. And so I had no idea what I would be doing with it. It just seemed cool. I mean, like at the time, you kind of had to pick in school if you were going to be like the classical person or the jazz. And then when you went to the conservatory, you actually had to pick. You were either a classical major or a jazz major. And I was a classical major.
Is that right? So, should it be that way?
No, of course not. But I mean, it's crazy. But the jazz students like have really, really fast minds. So they can think faster than the classical musicians of what kind of melodies to play and things like that, articulations. And the classical musicians just have a better foundation of playing. They more fundamentals. They can play more stuff. And so it's very interesting that they're so divided when they could learn so much from each other. But so I was actually the first person at my conservatory. This was outside of New York City, who was allowed to be in the jazz ensembles from the classical majors. The first ever.
Ooh. And I groundbreaker. It was what,
2013? Like this, we were past this. Damn. How am I the first person? And I had to literally audition for the jazz conservatory in order to be allowed to just be in one of the ensembles. So it's backwards and slow, slow.
Are you familiar with Adam Neely?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. He lives not far from where I went to school.
Because he's talked about this before, about how kind of these institutions are a little stuffy.
It's weird on the jazz side because the people teaching it did not go to school for jazz because that's how young the art form is. The people teaching it were young, like now they're in their 60s, early 70s, something like that. And so when they were young, they were practicing jazz and people were like shunning them for doing that. And then some like jazz orchestra picked them up. I played in the Woody Herman band when I was 18 years old and then was on tour with them. Like, and that's how they have this professorship now. And you're like, of course I want to learn from the guy who was in that amazing band. But they never went to school for jazz. So they are now coming up with it kind of in real time of like how to teach jazz at a conservatory. So it's a very weird moment where like classical music has been taught forever and that has its own set of issues. But like, they're figuring it out as they go. And if you ask like, well, what did you do when you were in school? They didn't. So, I mean, now there's another group of teachers who did, but yeah, it's very interesting to look that those are the people who are literally like writing the curriculum and it really hasn't been done for very long.
Can I ask why trombone is so like underrepresented just in popular music?
For real.
I was trying to like prepare for this and have like, here's like the favorite songs that you might not think have great. And
Chicago,
outside of literally one of my favorite songs of all time.
Yeah.
So why is that?
The reason Chicago does have trombone is because the guy who arranges their parts is a trombone player, Jimmy Pankow. So that's literally the reason. And the reason it's really good music for trombone is because he's the one that's writing it. Most people look at a trombone, even like accomplished musicians, and it just seems like more work to edit, more work to put in. It's typically like when you think of the trombone, it's not in tune. It's like it doesn't fit in with the other instruments. And so people just typically don't use it because that's what they think of when they think of a trombone. They don't think of like the glorious like angelic choir that I think of, or like the funky stuff from James Brown and stuff. They don't think about that aspect of it. And they think, well, I can accomplish the same thing with a trumpet and a couple saxes, which is kind of true without the like glissiness that gets in the way. But if you have somebody who really knows what they're doing, like that adds so much to it. So yeah, I guess it's my kind of like personal life goal to inject that back in just because it's what I play. But I actually just had this conversation with Jack Conte because I was like, you don't use trombone. And I think you have a good reason, so tell me. And he was like, yeah, it's just like, it just takes more time and more effort to like put even just horns in on these short recording sessions. So I think it's actually our fault for not being able to like adapt as well. And a lot of trombone players just kind of sit there and they're like, well, give me the music and I'll play it. And they're not willing to like take that initiative to be like, well, the music says this, but I think they want this, you know, and really like making it elevating it rather than just like doing their job. So there's a lot of reasons, but I mean, it is in everything. You just don't know it.
Yeah, I would think if a band, you know, wanted to use a trombone, that might be just for a little spice here and there, and it's probably easier just to synthesize it. Is that what you would call it? Using a synth or something that sounds basically like a trombone if it's only for a little bit, rather than have to hire somebody.
Yeah, we call those MIDI horns. And anytime I see one of my friends doing something with MIDI horns, I go, you don't have to pay me. Send it to me. I will record the parts. Like, you don't know how much
the right way, damn it.
It could be. I mean, you guys maybe run into Ali Spagnola a few times throughout these events and things. And she's the one that, like, she now knows better, and she'll be like, all right, I need you to record this stuff. But I work with her all the time because she's always putting MIDI horns on, and I'm like, all right, you can't do that anymore. It's not allowed. You need to let me do this. So, yeah.
It's like bringing AI into it or something.
You know,
I think.
It's funny. There was this ad that was clearly targeted towards me that was like, AI brass. And I was like, uh-oh. Like, this is it. This is the time.
You're saying that to me?
And so I pulled it up. I was like, let's see how good it is. And it's terrible. So I'm like, okay, I still have a couple years, you know. but I mean, it'll happen. But the nuance is not in like how it sounds. It's the like almost the parts that aren't written, the parts that aren't what you're supposed to do. So you're like holding over a note a little bit, or playing it shorter than you're supposed to, or even just like the difference between
the
notes.
Expressiveness.
Yeah. And it's not the stuff that you would ever write, because then it will look crazy on the page. And so in order to actually program something to do it like correctly, you would have to write all of that stuff out. And I think it's easier to just hire somebody to do it at this point, you know, give it 2 years and it'll probably be able to say like, oh, the Christopher Bill AI, and it'll just do all the inflections that I would have done. But you know, for now, my job is somewhat safe.
You're safe
for now.
So you've made a whole bunch of covers. Mm-hmm. Out of all of them, is there any one that just perfectly fit trombone that you're just like, trombone should almost be in the original song now?
That's a good question. I think the answer is no. And that's why the videos are interesting to watch, because it's the process of shoving this, you know, song into the trombone box and trying to make that actually like work by the end. That's what's interesting about it. If it just worked, I mean, there are some that were like brass band songs. There's one called Brooklyn by Youngblood Brass Band. So like, of course those work. It was written for brass to begin with. And then there are a few that just like range wise really work from certain like vocal ranges, like Michael Bublé or something, like has a very trombone, if he doesn't take offense to this, trombone vocal range.
I've always thought that.
Yeah, everybody says it. So yeah, there are a few that just kind of fit really well in that kind of range. And typically I'm for like a female voice, I'm doing what we would call extended techniques. It's a lot higher than you would typically play on the trombone, which is, again, is why these are kind of interesting to especially brass players, because they're like, wow, that's impressive or interesting, but definitely doesn't like fit well on the instrument. I'm doing something that's not typical in order to do that. So yeah, some of those vocal ranges or just kind of stylings, but nothing really comes to mind. It's all a little bit of a juggling act.
I went to your YouTube channel and I searched by your most popular video. Mm-hmm. And I just have a question about how 100 trombonists get together. And maybe the story behind that video was it for the purpose of that video? Because it was amazing.
Man.
It's so funny to think about like things that go viral, because it's, especially at the beginning, it's not the ones you think are going to. That was at the International Trombone Festival. And I was hired to lead the youth workshop. So it's a bunch of middle school and high school kids coming together, and they have little breakout groups. And then at the end, my big thing was I put them all together and I write something for everybody to play. And I put that video up for the parents to see their kids play.
Really? That was just a cute thing for the parents, huh?
Literally,
and
like
those kids have a story for a lifetime.
Isn't that insane? Like to be a middle schooler who played trombone and now like 10 million people saw you play.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Never supposed to go viral. And I should also note, this is getting into the weeds, which I'm sure you like to do sometimes. The title of the video, like it was just like the auto-generated thumbnail, and the title of the video was like ITF Youth Workshop featuring, and then there's three soloists who nobody outside of our world has ever heard of. But to us, we're like, oh, those amazing, like Jürgen von Rijn from the Concertgebouw Orchestra. Oh my gosh. Nobody cares, right? But we care. And so this was for the parents. There it is. And then I was talking to my friend Charles Cornell. Have either of you run into him on YouTube or otherwise? He's a piano player. He would do these. He became very popular by posting these videos of like celebrities like Cardi B talking, and he would actually analyze the music of it and play along with just the vocalizations and turn it into like a jazz harmony of just her talking. But we actually went to school together, and then he blew up way bigger than I ever will. And so we were talking about like analytics and stuff. He's in the Nebula group and stuff. And so he goes, you know, you should change the like thumbnail and the title. It already had gotten like 3 million views. And I was like, well, I mean, it's already viral. Like, what's going to happen? He goes, well, it's trailed off. Like, just try something. Try like, you know, 100 plus trombonists. Like, nobody cares about that other stuff. I'm like, that's true. Changed it, put the Avengers thing in the thumbnail, and it went from 3 million to like 10 million. like it had completely like leveled off. And then just by changing that stuff, it literally more than doubled when it was already completely viral. So yeah, very crazy to think about.
Yeah,
stuff.
See, when I hear those stories, I want to go through my old videos and just start tweaking them and do that, because you know, I've got videos, I'm sure do too, that are, they probably get like one view a week or something, you know. It's like nobody knows they even exist.
Yeah, it's very true. I've definitely seen like when ChatGPT came out, there were a bunch of the science creators who had old videos about that stuff, and they like completely changed the title to be like AI, whatever. And they were coming up in my For You page, and I'm like, this video is like 7 years old. They didn't make this about ChatGPT, but yeah, really interesting.
I have a couple of questions about the trombone.
I was hoping you might, as the ambassador.
I always was confused, like how do you teach somebody where to that slide? I'm sure this is a common question. Where that slide is, because there's no like lock-in point, like there is keys on any other instrument. Right. So it seems to me very vague, and that would be very dependent on a person's arm length and all of this. So how is that taught?
You make some good points. So there's a new company that came out, I don't know, 4 years ago, that actually creates this mechanism that you put on it that locks in the seven positions. And it has fabricated the community, because some people think it's great as a teaching tool, because now you do have very physical things that you can go to. And some people hate it, because the reason the trombone actually is better than the other stuff is because you can do stuff that is in between the valves, right? You can do something in between the keys on the piano. And so, I mean, this is really going out there, but when you play like a normal, like major chord, right? Something very, very simple on a piano, all of the notes are actually kind of, they call it equal temperament tuning. They're all a little bit off from what they're supposed to be perfectly in tune. They're all just a kind of fudging it just a little bit so you can play in any key. Because if you tuned everything perfectly to one key, it would sound terrible in all the other keys. And so you want to be able to play in every key on the piano. So you basically equal temperament. You adjust them just enough so everything sounds basically right. But on trombone, you can literally play everything perfectly in tune. It's called just tuning. Or perfect intonation. And so having that ability to not actually play every slide position perfectly, every note is actually in a slightly different place on the horn. And so what I would like to say is, at the beginning, it is so hard to learn trombone, but you get to a certain point in any instrument, and now like a trumpet has a third valve slide where they're having to play alternate like valve combinations and move a slide at the same time to make it be in tune, or having to use their lips to change it. And when you use your lips to change it, the actual like sound quality goes down. And with trombone, you don't have to do that. And so you get to a certain point, all of a sudden, now you understand those concepts and it gets easier to play trombone than any of the other instruments because you just go, well, I know where that note sits and it's kind of in between second and third position. I know where it feels on the horn. And so that first like 7 years, 6 years of trombone are hell. It's wow. So much harder than any other instrument to be like, it's so easy to be like, okay at all the other instruments. It's so hard to be okay at trombone. And then it flips and it's like easier to be great at trombone and harder to be great at those other instruments because now you're having to kind of fix those things that the instrument itself isn't allowing you to do where, yeah, the trombone has the ability, but you really want those constraints at the beginning. And so we teach 7 slide positions for the first few years, and then eventually there are a couple things where we go, well, that specific note is actually a little bit lower than that or a little bit higher than that, and you start learning the like actual stuff.
At the same time you're learning the positions and the mechanics of a trombone, you're really having to refine your ear. Mm-hmm. Probably better than other instruments. I think a kid in the fourth grade can play a G on a saxophone and be like, yeah, that's basically a G. I don't know. But I think for a trombone, I would expect you have to have that ear that is
so
spot on.
You don't have the ear, and so it just sounds bad is really what it is. Again, I think this is why people don't use trombone and things, because they think about that version. But you get to a certain point, yeah. And you also mentioned you're growing, like the different length of your arm is changing, and that makes a big difference. You know, people are having to, like people develop this really bad habit of going out all the way on the slide where you basically move your shoulder and then it kind of like constricts your lungs and stuff.
Rotates.
And so you get bigger and you don't have to do that anymore, but you're still doing it because that's how you learned. And so, yeah, there are some bad habits that just have to be unlearned very strategically on the instrument, because you learn when you're in middle school and you're not big enough to play the instrument. I mean, it's a reason why a lot of like people who look like me, kind of tall and skinny, do play the instrument at a professional level, because they don't have to unlearn.
You can reach out there at that seventh position,
yeah, exactly.
Or whatever. Is there a note like at the very, very end of that slide? Is there ever a risk of it just like completely, oh, I went too far and that slide coming off?
Yeah. We were at a competition.
That's a dumb question, I know.
There's a competition when I was in middle school or high school for a jazz band competition, and one of the kids flung it off the end of the stage, and the judge had to come up and pick up the slide and give it to him. And he had to kind of like slink over to it, like pick it up.
Thank you.
It can happen. Not
the slide of shame.
Yeah, I have not had that happen in many years. Although there's a soprano trombone and a piccolo trombone. So a soprano trombone is half the size of a tenor trombone, mm-hmm. the regular one. And a piccolo trombone is a quarter.
It's basically a slide whistle.
So it's like a slide trumpet. Same notes as a trumpet, and then the piccolo is half the size of that, and so the slide is like a couple inches long. So yeah, that one I blow off the
really?
End all the time. But yeah,
well, so I've also seen trombones that have keys, like a trumpet. Mm-hmm. What are those? Is that like a bass trombone?
So that would be.
And how does that work?
Does it have a slide as well, or just the valves?
Yeah, a slide with the valves on a trombone. Is that something I'm imagining, or is that a real thing?
I think maybe both. I can't imagine you've seen this thing, but it does exist.
Okay, maybe not. Maybe not.
It's called a superbone, and it has valves and a slide. Do either of you remember Maynard Ferguson? He was a trumpet player who he developed this instrument that for him to play, which has valves and a slide, called the superbone. But there's also a valve trombone. There's a bass trumpet. They're all very similar in that kind of like they play the
valve
same notes,
trombone.
But they're just made a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Valve trombone, people definitely play that one, who are trumpet players who want the sound of a trombone, but don't want to learn the slide. They'll do a valve trombone. Yeah.
Hmm.
I just Googled image search.
You gotta be careful.
That's what she said.
Yeah. With that one. Mm-hmm. I'll just point.
But it'll come up. You'll get it.
That's also what she said.
Wow.
That's a long time. Well, you never thought you'd learn so much about the trombone.
I love it. That's why we have this show.
Is there generally a waning interest in analog instruments these days now that you can kind of replicate all of that and I don't have to worry about the nuance of how it sits in my mouth and da 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 when I can get my keyboard to do it?
I have such a weird part of this world where I'm mostly dealing with like YouTubers and video creators where the visual aspect of it is so interesting. You almost need that more than like you could play keys. It's not interesting to watch. And so I have friends who are learning trombone and trumpet who are not trombone and trumpet players in order to play it in their videos because they want the visual aspect of it more. Because of course, you could just play it. You could have somebody else do it. So in that world, I think it's actually coming back because it's interesting to look at, which is such a weird reason to play the trombone. But otherwise, I mean, I talk to producers all the time and yeah, they're just putting them on the MIDI keys and figuring out what that sounds like. And if the project has the budget to hire real people, maybe they do it, but maybe at the end they're used to hearing the MIDI so much. I mean, who was it? Harry Styles came out with a song, like a number one song that uses MIDI horns on it. And I think they sound absolutely horrible, but it's like a certain sound that we are learning to know what it sounds like and attribute it to pop music. And so that's very scary for me, honestly, where it's like, oh, no, I don't want the real sounding horns. I want the like this specific sound that I get from MIDI horns. So, I mean, it happened in the 80s a little bit, too, where it's like clearly like this weird patch that kind of sounds like horns. It's supposed to be that, but
yeah,
that's a little bit scary for me, for sure.
I think that's interesting. You mentioned the importance of the visual, and I think that's why there is so much popularity in these kind of videos is because there's a certain juxtaposition that we're not expecting. And it kind of reminds me of the popularity of these music in the style of kind of videos like Scott Bradley's Postmodern Jukebox has been doing this. One of my favorites for a while where, you know, he'll take pop songs and put them in a jazz version or blues version or whatever. And I think people just like to see something they're not expecting to see, such as a trombone playing something that they're familiar with, a pop song.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing that actually kind of brought new life back into this stuff that I was doing, because it was basically just this song on trombone. And then I started to do more of like this song, but it's funk, you know, but it's jazz. And that creates so much more creativity and style that goes into it, because what kind of funk, which funk band am I emulating? Which jazz style am I emulating? Like there's that means it's a lot different, and it's based on my own things that I've heard. And I go, well, this part of the song reminds me of that song. I'm going to like emulate that. I'm going to, you know, quote that. So it's way different than the old version, which I still do sometimes, which is just, yeah, it's all of the things you heard in the regular song, but now it's on trombone. Like it's interesting enough, I guess, but yeah, adding my own flavor into it is definitely, I think, why people have stuck around.
What would your advice be to someone who like literally wanted to try becoming a musician for a living or doing something related to it, which would still kind of like fill that void?
I mean, for me, the only thing that worked was combining my passions. So it wasn't just music. It was music and sociology and marketing and video editing. And like, if I didn't love all of those aspects, I would not be doing exactly what I'm doing. And it's the reason I'm not in an orchestra is that like, that doesn't speak to me nearly as much. It's kind of at all, honestly, anymore. So I would say kind of make a list of all your passions and figure out what that weird, like if you like law and music, there's copyright lawyers. Like there's something that combines most things. Now, somebody did like stump me once and I was like, yeah, like I could do this with anything. And they said like fisherman or something. I was like, hey, I don't really write a song about fish. I don't know. But there's always like something that makes a lot of sense that you're going to be the person to do that. Like I said, my career only happened when I combined those things. I could be one of a million people who plays trombone, but I'm the one person who does this. And my heroes are now reaching out to me to be like, all right, so if I want to do social media stuff, like what do I need to do? Like they're asking me these questions.
Right.
And my YouTube friends who have like millions of followers are asking me about music. So like, it's only when I have both of those camps that I can actually have some sort of expertise and feel like I have my own thing. And that's when it's easy. And then you don't have to ask like, well, what do I do next? You know the next steps because you're super passionate about it and you could get turned down for many jobs and you still know what you're going to do next because that's what's fueling you anyway.
Can I ask you some legal questions actually? Because maybe one of the thoughts is people not knowing kind of how they can work with other people's music to be able to like post a video or do a cover of it or whatnot. What do you have to do in order to actually post a video like that?
So some of the companies, like the platforms, have not figured this out yet. I think they kind of ignored it for a while and just were happy to run ads on the videos and collect the money and hope nobody noticed and be like, well, it was the users who uploaded the stuff, so it's not on us. And then clearly it is. So YouTube now, it's called a sync license, which is basically putting somebody else's music to video. It's my own arrangement, it's my own performance, it's my own video, but you still need a sync license to take, like, somebody else wrote this song and I want to put it to a video. It's made for using music in commercials, but it applies to this as well. So you need a sync license and YouTube just does that for you. It's called revenue split or content ID, where it figures out who owns the rights. You basically, it just does it automatically. You can dispute it if it's wrong, but you don't need anything now, which is totally not what it was before. So that's pretty great. And Facebook is starting, they've kind of figured it out, TikTok a little bit. So they're starting to figure out how to pay the people who should get paid. If it's a smaller artist, you could just reach out to them and just ask, and sometimes they'll give it to you for free. Sometimes they'll say, yeah, like $100 for whatever, 10,000, 100,000 views or something like that. And you basically just have to re-up as you hit that. For putting something on like Spotify, it's a mechanical license, and those are getting very, very easy to just get. And you just fill out a form online and pay a certain amount of money depending on where it's going and how it's being distributed. And you can, yeah, put your covers on Spotify and on iTunes and everything. And then, so that's a mechanical license. And then there's like a print license to sell sheet music. There's a master license if you want to actually use the actual track, that the original. So if you want to like, I guess a derivative license is to like change the original in a substantial way. So there's a lot of different ones, but mostly what I do is make the YouTube video and put the sheet music out. So that's a sync license and a print license. And then if I put it on like an album or something, that's a mechanical license. So those are the three that I use. But if you're just putting out a YouTube video, you really don't need to do anything. The rights holders hold all of the power, so they can take your video down. They can remove it in certain countries. They have all the power. You're not in legal jeopardy if they say like, I don't want that out there. It's like, well, then you can take it down. There's no legal repercussions there. They just have the power there. And then of course you can dispute it if it's wrong, but I've had 750 videos or something and I've never had that happen. So it's scary, especially for schools who hire these lawyers and they're like, oh, just don't do it. But it's honestly fine if you're doing your own covers.
How much of a piece of music can I use before I actually need to do anything with
it? And how much does it need to actually sound like the original?
So if you're just talking about like using somebody else's song in a video, that's very different than my cover of it. So if you're using the actual recording, I believe the answer is, people say like it's like 2 or 3 seconds. I believe the answer is none. I think that's a myth.
I think you're right.
For my own stuff, I think that was like just something people said for a while. For my own covers, it's insane how much it knows. So it's my own arrangement, like in a different style of this song. And within, I don't know, 2 minutes of uploading the video, it goes, this is the song, this is who owns the rights. It's crazy. So that content ID is right. It's gotten it wrong a couple times. It doesn't do like medleys very well if you're combining different songs. But it's really impressive. Now I have, you know, obviously quoted different songs in things. It's not going to get that stuff. And also, I don't think anybody's going to come after you for quoting like a little melody inside of a song. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty close to fair use, if not just kind of definite fair use, where you're changing the original completely, and it could never be a substitute for the original. So,
or even just sampling, I would imagine, might be a problem here and there.
Sampling, yeah, can be an issue. You usually want to like contact the folks, and they're usually willing to do it. You just have to, you know, jump through a couple hoops first.
The guys I really feel bad for are these guys who are trying to do music analysis of various songs or bands or everything. And because they're trying to do an actual essay on something and talk about a song, but you can't use the song. It's very frustrating for me because I love those kinds of videos, and I feel bad for them because it's like, man, they have a real hard time with this, it seems like.
It's really interesting because I started some lesson courses on arranging. And so I'm using examples of the songs and I play them and I show the sheet music on it. I'm just showing little sections of it, right? Just the parts that you need to show to illustrate what's happening. And that is cut and dry fair use, educational purposes. And so I was talking to some folks, and Devin over at Legal Eagle was talking about this as well. And he said, well, what happens is, especially for this case, is people are basically doing the first round of copyright strikes, which is, oh, that's my song, you can't use it. And you say, look, well, it's fair use. And they decline it, right? And then you get into the copyright strike, the three strikes you're out on YouTube, which mm-hmm. we're all scared of.
Right.
We actually are correct in saying that we can use that. But nobody wants to do it because you're scared of the strike. So they're using the strike to basically collect your money. And so he sent this thing over to a couple of creators of exactly what to type in when you dispute it.
Oh,
and
nice.
So I was like pretty scared to do it, but I started a new channel. So I was like, even if it gets a strike, it's fine. It's just for the lesson courses. It's not my main channel. And it worked like a charm. I mean, this thing is very scary looking. It's like, you are collecting my royalties that are fair use, so we are countersuing you. Please, like
that's aggressive.
This section of the like Supreme Court like shows this exact like ruling clearly states, like, please send your legal counsel information over, email address and phone number and address, and we will send like our countersuit. And guess what? I got that went very quickly. They said, no, thank you.
Devin
for the
win.
Use, all you.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think most people just are scared of that like copyright strike, and they're using that to take our money, really, is what it is. And we're willing to do that just to like stay out of that. But no, I mean, those videos that you're talking about are, if they're not just like playing the whole song and listening to it and not commentating on it, that's different. But if they're literally just saying like, oh, listen to this section of the song, here's what's happening, that's black and white fair use. So I wish more people would know about this, that you can dispute that the second time. They're just clicking the button and saying like, oh, they're probably not gonna appeal, so we just get
are you
to
familiar
keep
with David Bennett David Bennett Piano? I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a British guy, I think. But he was trying to analyze some Beatles songs, and he actually took the effort to recreate them on his own complete songs. It's pretty amazing.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, Beatles is definitely the one that keeps coming up. They hit that fast.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to use those. But yeah, I mean, technically, I guess you can.
You don't want Paul to send Paul to the poorhouse or anything, you know?
Yeah, I know. That he's... He's scraping by.
Poor Ringo. <Huh? laughs>
How do you avoid burnout? You've been doing this long enough. You've gone through those times.
I mean, I mentioned those like December projects were pretty big to just kind of change it. Those videos that are completely for me and not like a little bit for the audience, is just for me, kind of like doing the weird thing that's so niche that only I think I will like it, and sometimes I'm right and that's fine. And then sometimes you just get burnt out and you gotta take some time off, like that's also a thing. sometimes you have to convert a Tesla into a recording studio and run away.
Do you have goals for the channel?
Goals for the channel. I mean, okay. So after this Patreon event, if you really want to get into it. I was realizing like my niche is like limited unless I want to change what I'm doing foundationally. We don't know what that limit is, but it's limited. And all of these things from like VidCon and creator events are talking about growth and optimization and right, like these scalability are like these are the words that everybody uses. Of like, oh, like hire more people out so you're not doing all the work. And I'm like, that's like I get that. Like I am the bottleneck in my creation. I get that. But at a certain point, like depending on what you're making, it may not be scalable, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean it's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. It just means like you can't hire a million people to do this stuff. It's like, that's not your sphere. Now, I don't know what my ceiling is. I thought my ceiling was 1,000 people and it's at 300,000 or more. So it's like, I don't know what that ceiling is, but if I start making stuff that's different than what my audience wants to reach a broader audience, I'm turning my back on the people who built this channel, right? So that's one thought. But then I came back from this Patreon event and I started digging into the analytics, and it's crazy, this like thing that I'm going to be coming out with a video soon about this to kind of rebrand and re kind of negotiate everything, even with the followers. But basically, like, what is the rate that somebody watches one of my videos and then does something else? Like, somebody that really cares about what I'm making. So do they go to my Spotify? Do they go to my Patreon? Do they, like, do something? Even just go to, like, the long form video if I make, like, a, you know, a short form clip. Do they go to the YouTube channel? And it's about, like, 1 in 100 if a video, like, does abysmally bad and gets 100 views. One of them will go over, or two. Which is a pretty large percentage, if you think about it.
I was going to say, that's pretty big, actually.
Then for 1,000, it's fantastic, right? For 1,000 people, about 10 go over, right? So 1%, good. If a video blows up and gets 1 million or 2 million views, it's about 20 people that go over. And so you're like, okay, so what's happening there? Well, this is reaching a crazy broad audience, which of course we think is the goal. It makes us feel really good about ourselves. But for my niche, all of those people, basically statistically, all of those people don't care about what I'm making. They care enough to like it or comment or whatever, but it's reaching a group of people who do not care about what I'm doing. And so I'm chasing this thing that is like, literally, if I just got a couple thousand people, it would be the same turnover for me personally. And so I'm basically kind of recontextualizing everything I'm doing to being like, I'm not trying to reach the viral people because it's not for them. It's clearly not for them. They don't even like care to do anything. So trying to reach just those core people that are making this sustainable and have made it sustainable for 10 years is the goal. And actually the viral stuff is kind of making it harder, which is so weird to think about now because it's easier to go viral.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah.
Like the next video I do after something goes viral, they're trying all of these people who didn't care in the first place. And so those videos do worse. It's really interesting to think about it this way when of course we're trying to like reach the most people possible. And I'm like, am I really, or am I just trying to reach the people that care the most within my niche? I mean, if you're made like videos that were super mainstream and like accessible to everybody, well then yeah, of course reaching more people are going to like it. But that's not what I'm like, trombone videos aren't for everybody. We knew this from the beginning. So like, who am I actually trying to reach? It's really interesting.
He speaks for Big Trombone. Trying to push his trombone agenda on everyone.
That's right. Yeah.
And you can
I'm a divisive figure in the trombone community. let's be very clear. Within the trombone community, it splits. Oh yeah. I mean, I'm older now, but 10 years ago, this young kid who's getting all this popularity, like he doesn't even sound that good. Like, why does he get it? And I don't. I've been playing for 60 years. Oh yeah. People don't know what to think about me. He's just playing pop music. He's not even playing real music.
I think that's true in every genre on YouTube, because if you're doing something, some sort of art, craft, anything like that, there's going to be the people who have been doing it forever but haven't been online and are like, what is this? You're horrible. You're ruining everything.
Congratulations. That's how you know you made it. Yeah. So well done. You're yeah. pissing well, off yeah. the establishment.
I still get those comments from people, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Like you're doing it all wrong. Like, yeah, oh, they're like, your that technique, is not whatever.
Yeah, a lot of the gate, they're usually the gatekeepers. They're like, well, you're just doing this for views. You don't really know mm-hmm. what you're a hack.
What's the most hack thing you think you've done?
Oh, probably the most hack thing I've done on a woodworking channel. Well, probably the when I do like these 10, I haven't done them in a while, but the listicle videos.
A listicle.
Like, these are the things that you actually need. And this is how, because it's, those things are very definitive, but I feel like I've gotten away from those. This past year I've spent trying to get more, it sounds similar to you. I'm really trying to get more back to that core audience and not be as interested in the mm-hmm. larger YouTube. I definitely see the value of that. I think a lot of this became clearer when I started noticing the effects shorts were having on my channel, because if a short would kind of pop off and get a lot of views, those people are just scrolling through. They don't give a shit about my channel or anything else, and they're not coming back. And
not
so then
all.
You've got this wide range between people who are subscribed to your channel and the actual people who are watching the channel. And I think that those are kind of detrimental to your channel. I think viral videos can really harm a channel in some way. I think, again, unless your channel that's kind of based on that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think we're like kind of heading into a seismic shift and like people moving away from trying to go viral and starting to try to build that community again that we had 10 years ago. I mean, it's funny talking to you guys who yeah. remember that part where it's like, no, this used mm-hmm. to be like I would see the same people commenting every week. I knew the people. And now it's, yeah, it's different.
Those subscribers were important. And I felt like I when people subscribed, they really wanted to watch my videos. Now it's not really the case.
I think they do want to watch our videos.
They do. They just want it to be exactly kind of what it was at that time. But what it ends up being from that time is usually like that. Those were the periods that you were writing the videos without really worrying about what people were going to say about them, and you allow yourself to be more selfish and all of that other good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to see any more of this drama, if you want to see why he's such a divisive figure in the trombone community, the YouTube channel is at Classical Trombone. You are also on Instagram and you are on the TikTok. Actually, do you do the TikTok, don't you?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I had Classical Trombone on all the things, yeah.
And on Spotify. And now you get to add to that list an appearance on the Chat and See Have a podcast.
Yes.
So you have that going.
You've made it.
I really feel like I have. This was super fun.
Thanks for joining us, Christopher. Yeah. We really enjoyed it.